fiscally responsible, financial geniuses, monetary magicians. These are things people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds. Because Progressive offers discounts for paying in full, owning a home, and more. Plus, you can count on their great customer service to help when you need it, so your dollar goes a long way. Visit Progressive.com to see if you could save on car insurance. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states or situations.
What's up, fools? Main Event Jey Uso here from the WWE. When it's just me between matches, it's day one-ish. And that means it's Chumba time. With hundreds of casino-style games and new titles arriving weekly, there's always something fresh to try at Chumba Casino. The daily boosts make it even more fun. And have me about to get them all during my downtime. Ready for a fun way to chill out and enjoy a few minutes for yourself? Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Welcome to another episode of Breaking Math. Today we'll be diving deep into the captivating world of games and their profound impact on culture, strategy, and learning with none other than the esteemed Professor Marcus Dussatoy, a British mathematician, Simony Professor for Public Understanding of Science at the University of Oxford, Fellow of New College, Oxford, a chair formerly held by His Eminence Sir Richard Dawkins, and an author of popular mathematics and science books, including Around the World in 80 Games. He was previously a fellow of All Souls College, Oxford, Wadham College, Oxford, and served as president of the Mathematical Association, an Engineering and Physical Science Research Council Senior Media Fellow, and a Royal Society University Research Fellow. Join us as we embark on a journey through the universality and cultural significance of games, from ancient traditions to the cutting edge of technology. In this episode, we'll explore how games differ across regions like India and China, dissect the balance between strategy and chance, and reflect on the educational importance of games that have been played or banned throughout history. Professor Dussatoy also illuminates the power and prowess of AI in modern gameplay with an unforgettable discussion about a groundbreaking move by AlphaGo. But that's not all. We'll touch on the expanding field of NFTs and blockchain in gaming and how they can change the face of digital ownership and fairness. Our conversation with Professor Dussatoy will span across a variety of topics, revealing the connections between games and intellectual disciplines such as anthropology, philosophy, and psychology. It's all right here on Breaking Math.
Before we begin today's interview, I have a quick announcement. The Breaking Math podcast will be doing a giveaway of the book Around the World in 88 Games by Marcus Dussatoy. Just stay tuned to the end of this episode for instructions. Also, follow us on all social media. That is at Breaking Math Media on Instagram, as well as at Breaking Math Pod on X, which used to be Twitter. Soon we will be at Breaking Math Media on all platforms, but if you search for either at Breaking Math Media or at Breaking Math Pod, you should find it. Just follow the instructions on our social media posts, and you should be eligible for being in a drawing for a free copy of the book. In previous conversations, we've had this really long pre-interview discussion, and it was some of our like most awesome content, and I never recorded it. So as a note to self, I record everything and usually just chop it off once I do my little intro, which we haven't even done yet. Secondly, and this, I'm glad I'm recording, this book has almost changed our podcast strategy. We are a math podcast, but reading this book, I'm exploding with ideas for how to create a card game, kind of like Magic the Gathering, but instead of magic characters, mathematicians and physicists. You know what I mean?
Brilliant. I thoroughly approve of that.
Oh, fabulous. And there's something else that I wrote in the show notes that I'll probably allude to in our actual interview as well, or I'll just cut this section in. Who knows? This book had so much information, both culturally but also mathematically, in the history of leisure, that I wanted to like hire a couple of high-performing interns to make as many visual diagrams and Excel spreadsheets where you can make all kinds of lists and maps of different games that are either that have a primarily creative element or a primary random strategy or a primary probabilistic strategy. Like, make as many maps as you can, go crazy, and then you could make a database for Find My Game. And you know what I mean? Like, you could do that.
Very
and
nice.
I was telling Autumn this, and Autumn was telling me that this is my first experience in the gaming literature. So as I understand from Autumn, some stuff like that may exist already. Is that right, Autumn?
There has been like some mapping, and I know that there's been a few college courses taught on this. So it, like, my background is, so I went to Hampshire College. I'm not sure if you're familiar with them. They are a school that has like no grades.
All right.
A lot of the, like the famous origami mathematician Tom Hull went there. Also there's been like seventh generation cleaning products, Stonyfield Farm organic yogurt, Lupita Nyong'o. I believe Kathy Najimy's child went there. And it's just like a lot of big names that come through. And along with that, there's a lot of tech giants, and over like 30 or 40% of the people that go into like studying really niche topics and go on to their PhDs, and like they specialize in a lot of games and game theory and board games, and it's people creating this from like the ground up. And I had like the privilege of going there.
Wow, amazing.
And
yeah,
working with some of these folks, and they have like the one of the like libraries for all the board games, and some of them are uncharted and unmapped like board games, and some of them are half created, and you can go in there and like
that sounds
work
amazing.
On one
oh,
of them.
That sounds, yes, very dangerous. I'm not sure you ever come out.
Like, yep, so some people don't. So like it just kind of fascinated me just reading through the book itself, and I'm like, this is something that I can see paralleling a
yeah.
lot of your work and other folks' work. And I'm like, this is wonderful.
Didn't they make a game about that? The game like Jumanji or something? Like, you know what I mean? Like, you could do a riff on Jumanji, kind of like that, where you're just stuck in these board games. Or something between Jumanji and Saw, where it's like a horror movie, but it's also games. I don't know. My brain is getting creative here. We did an early podcast on game theory where we did an imitation of Saw, where my co-host used the Adobe version of Photoshop, but for sound, and I'm blanking on the name of it. What's the name of it? I forget.
It's not Audacity, but...
Oh my gosh, this is embarrassing. I should know this. The Adobe version of their sound... Okay, uh-huh. He made my voice the exact same voice as the Jigsaw in the movie Saw, and he had this whole long thing that we read at the very end of it. It was a device that would like tickle your feet or something. It was hilarious, but it was fun. It was fun. Sorry. That's not math related. We don't have to keep that.
That's fine.
Very good. So I actually think it's entirely appropriate to start the episode just with all of the explosive ideas that came from this. And, you know, even on my ideas here, I almost have more extensions on this book, which I'll probably have to write about in an email, because I'm curious, you know, in your other interviews about this book, have other people approached you about extensions to do based on this book?
Well, the interesting thing is that so many people come with new games that I've not encountered before. I mean, this was never meant to be an encyclopedic kind of book on games. So it was always meant to be my favorite games and the ones that I encountered. And I realized that I can probably go around the world in 160 games now because of all the new things. I mean, you know, for example, there are interesting books which have games at their heart. So I put two in the as the games in my 80 games, one being the Glass Bead game, by Hermann Hesse. But since then, you know, people have come back with really interesting books that I didn't know about, which have games at their heart. So that I'd love to put in another version of the book. So I think the extension will be Let Me Go Around the World Again. And drop off in, you know, various different places that people said, why didn't you go here? And I said, well, I can't be everywhere. So
Have you ever thought about maybe, now I don't know if this would interest you or not, depends on your desires, making a wiki of it so all the game enthusiasts can like insert a thing onto your landing page or something? You know what I mean? Like, well, that would grow it like a fractal.
Yeah. There's a lot of that already out there, actually. And it was, you know, good resources actually out there for me helping to write this book.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
You're listening to a podcast right now. Driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own is free and easy. Upload an episode, and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and hundreds more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads like this, even with just 10 listeners a month. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start free at RSS.com.
One of the things that I always said, look, you're not going to learn the rules of the game from reading this book. That's not the point of this book. And there are so many wonderful sites out there for board game geek kind of websites. Also just fantastic YouTube channels. I mean, that's my go-to place for when I'm learning a game for the first time is to go to these people who are wonderful, are just condensing the game into 10 minutes on a YouTube video. I watch that and then I'm ready to share the rules with my family because they kind of really distilled the essence. So there's great resources out there. And this is meant to be, you know, the thing about a wiki is that it's very non-narrative based. And I wanted this, and that was one of the challenges of writing this book in a way, because it could have been very listy. It could have been very just like, and I really wanted to try and find some way to motivate people to read it in a kind of narrative way. And so that's why I use kind of like Phileas Fogg's journey around the world. And it sort of follows roughly the journey, but of course I add a few kind of distractions on. I mean, Phileas Fogg never had to go to Australia or New Zealand. And I felt, well, I need to at least spend a little bit of time there. So, and also just, you know, it follows quite a historical narrative. So it starts in the Middle East, in kind of ancient times, and board games are back to 5,000 years. So there's a kind of historical narrative and a geographical narrative. And so I think that was quite important to me. So I would love it for somebody else to then take what's happened there as the beginning to a wiki if they wanted to. But for me, the challenge is going the other way, you know, to take this huge swathe of people that have written about games, put wonderful things on about games, and then choosing a pathway through that. And that's sort of what an author, the challenge of being an author is how do I take you on a journey through something that you could probably, anybody could go on, just get lost on the internet reading about games. But the point is, I'm going to curate for you my journey through this in a way that I think tells you a story.
Wow, very cool. And that's one element that I love with this. So one of the focuses of the Breaking Math podcast specifically is bringing together mathematics as well as arts and humanities, and the challenge of doing that and explaining how those two, let's just say for lack of a better term, human activities work together and complement each other. And I think that the historical elements were fascinating. The story of the Buddha in this book surprised me. I have a very limited, very Western-centric version of the Buddha that I've learned about. And when I read about all of the games that he banned, well, first of all, I was very sad about that. But then I thought about why? You know, like, is there an anthropo-?
No, I agree. I was quite surprised why he banned games, especially because actually, as I talk about in the book, something like Snakes and Ladders had actually, a very educational role in helping people to understand the impact of good and bad karma on their lives. So that game is actually about the challenge of reaching nirvana, moksha, paradise, and what you can help to make this version of your life, because interestingly, Snakes and Ladders, you get reborn in the Indian version, so you don't wait trying to throw the score to get to the winning square. You go back to the beginning if you missed the winning square. So you go round and round, sort of being reborn. So I was quite intrigued that why that's clearly a game which has kind of the idea of reaching nirvana at its heart. Yet the Buddha really didn't want it. Games as part of the journey to that his followers would take part in. So yeah, I was a bit disappointed because, you know, I'm also quite keen on Buddhism as a religion, and there he is saying no, you can't play any of these games.
Yeah, let me, if I may, I want to read some of the list of games. Yeah, that he, I don't know, hilarious. If he banned them or okay somersaults. No doing somersaults. Any games with dice, games with dice, you can't play those. Any games with imaginary rows or games played on boards with 8 or 10 rows. So you can't imagine playing chess.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. Don't even think about it.
Okay. And I am going to take the liberty of doing a very quick aside. I want to consult with my friends who are studying cognitive religion and anthropology, because I'm interested in banned things across culture. I am aware that there are schools of thought in Islam, for example, that ban all stringed instruments, for example. And, you know, my question would be, from an evolutionary standpoint, the utility, and not only the utility, but the perception of things being somehow bad. How does that vary from culture to culture? And is there some explanation of not only the initial idea of the rules, but how they evolved and how context matters? Like, this is a whole area that I want to come back to, because, you know, I love my idea of the Buddha and the fact that, okay, here we go. You can't play anything where you make pictures of things with red dye on your hand, so something like Pictionary. You can't do any games where you guess your opponent's thoughts. Dude, but children naturally.
That's 21
make
questions
games.
Out. You know, 21
oh, yeah.
questions. No.
Maybe
no,
20, just 20 questions then? Or I'm just kidding. You know what I mean? But like, and I guess I think, you know, just developmentally, I feel like out of just boredom and trying to exercise our brain, like, games are natural. Like, games are as natural as scratching an itch. I don't know. That's what I think.
What was interesting about that list was it gave me some insight, actually, to some of the games that were around during that period. For example, one of the games I talk about is Hopscotch. And Hopscotch is a game that, you know, has Christian kind of resonances, because they used to lay it out in kind of like a cross shape, and the squares would be labeled a bit like the Snakes and Ladders. You know, the last one would be heaven, and there'd be the journey towards heaven. But that's an indication, because one of the games that is banned is a description of something like Hopscotch. And so it makes you realize, oh, okay, Hopscotch was around then in the Indian subcontinent and being played much earlier than we thought than, say, European Christian hopscotch games. So the other one is, like, you're not allowed to play, if I remember, something with, you know, stacks of blocks where you pull blocks out and they topple. Well, that's Jenga. They had Jenga already in the, you know, Buddha's time. So that was quite interesting, just seeing that you could use that list to give you quite a lot of insight about the games that were around. There is one game in there which really should be banned, and I don't even understand how it was a game, which is Imitating Deformities.
Okay.
Now, yes. that is about the one game on that list that I approve of banning.
Yeah. No, I totally agree. Totally agree. Oh, anything with a ball. You can't play any game with a ball at all. Oh, my gosh. So how do you... Wow. That's amazing. But then now I'm also reminded of early, like, medieval monks and, like, aesthetic practices where people would, like, get on top of a pillar and remove themselves from society, or that scene in Monty Python when they whack themselves. I know it's based on the practice of, like, scourging yourself with a whip or something. I don't know, man. People trying to attain enlightenment are sometimes kind of prickly, kind of dry. Sorry.
Yeah, exactly. But I'm very interested by your kind of the goal of your podcast, because I think it's something I so resonate with, which is the idea that mathematics is part of culture and humanities. And, you know, in a way, that was why I love this, writing this book, because, you know, many people love playing games and many people have a very negative reaction to mathematics. And to be able to use the games as a way to show people, no, hold on, actually what you're doing is playing some mathematics. And you may not realize it, but that is at the heart. You're exploring the consequences of rules. And there is lovely maths to make these games so wonderfully playable. So, you know, the hope is that people buy this because they think it's a book about games, but actually then they realize, oh no, this is a maths book, but it's actually much more fun than I thought it was going to be. So, and I suppose I do that with a lot of my projects. You know, I do a lot of, in fact, I'm writing a new book at the moment, which is called Blueprints. And it's about the way that creative artists use mathematical structures, sometimes knowingly, sometimes intuitively, sometimes discovering.
Hey, it's Bubba Wallace from 2311 Racing. You know what it feels like forever? Sitting on a plane waiting for takeoff. Good thing I've got Chumba Casino. With daily boost and social casino games on tap, this is the kind of fun that makes time fly. Why not turbocharge your downtime? Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
You're listening to a podcast right now. Driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own podcast is free and easy. Upload an episode and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads just like this. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start your new podcast for free today at RSS.com.
Mathematical structures that perhaps we know about already, but they're making those discoveries within their artwork for the first time. So, you know, that finding those resonances and showing people that maths isn't a siloed subject all on its own, that it is just the language of the universe, of nature, of humanity, that's sort of one of my kind of missions in life.
I've been like exploring that essentially but on a personal level, since starting my journey with mathematics, I liked, before like being a mathematician and engineer, I like to say that I'm an artist first. so I've done a lot of work in origami. I've done origami dresses, incorporating a lot of those things and elements of the design into high-level engineering.
Yes, absolutely. And I do some work with an art college here in London, St. Martin's School for Art and Design. And they have a course which is Mathematics for Artists. And it's the course which is signed up for fastest by students there, because they suddenly realize by the time they're coming to university, to college, that these are skills they need. And the tragedy is, why aren't we actually taking this back to school level and making people realize earlier on? Because they suddenly realize, no, these skills are going to help me make things that I can conceive of in my mind, but, or even open up new structures that will lead to new artwork. So,
yes. Like, for example, when I was working with some of my students on one of their designs, I'm like, wait, what's going to actually work? Not only for optimization, but you also have to look at things from an aesthetic point of view. Do you want it to be structurally sound? Do you want it to be ugly? But it works. And it's really what is going to take that time. Like, you take that time and think about those things. And as engineers, we're not classically trained to think about that. You think about usually the UX, UI design of something. But it's really, where does that fine line of being an artist come in and saying, I'm in love with this piece, and where do we narrate that, right? So,
well, I'll tell you, one of the things that made me fall in love with mathematics and actually made me want to be a mathematician was reading a book which my teacher recommended for me at school, which you may know, called A Mathematician's Apology by G.H. Hardy.
Yes.
And this is a book written by a fantastic mathematician, number theorist in Cambridge, he wrote it about the 1940s, but he's writing about what it's like to be a mathematician. And he describes it, you know, being a mathematician is like being a painter or a poet. You are a maker of patterns. And he really stressed the creative side of being a mathematician. You know, a lot of people think mathematics is just the language to be able to do engineering, for example. But he said, no, that's the kind of boring bit of mathematics. And actually, there's a hugely creative part of mathematics. And, you know, I think that's why I decided to become a mathematician, maybe rather than, say, a physicist or another scientist, because I think there is more freedom within mathematics to create imaginary worlds which are not describing the universe around us. You see, in physics, you're sort of a bit bound by the physical universe. You're trying to describe that. And if your theory does not fit the physical universe, it might be a beautiful theory, really it's not interesting, so it's thrown out. But for a mathematician, that would have value as a self-consistent universe in its own right. And so we have many different sorts of geometry, Euclidean, of course, but non-Euclidean, so spherical, elliptical, hyperbolic. One of these will be the geometry of the universe, but all of them are interesting as geometries for a mathematician. We have finite geometries. One of them is important in making one of the games in my book, Spot It, or Dobble, as we call it in the UK. That is, you're actually playing a game which is based on an amazing bit of geometry. So for me, I think I loved mathematics because it was this bridge between the world of science. It certainly is, it's the language of science, and science really couldn't do many of the things without the mathematics, but it's also a very creative side. And that's what the book I'm writing at the moment is showing, how it's in the creative arts. But for me, it has a bit more of a freedom about it, which perhaps you don't have so much in the sciences, which is why I was drawn to it. And this book in particular, and if listeners haven't read this book, I really recommend it for just giving you an insight into what it's like to be a mathematician. It includes two proofs, one of there being infinitely many prime numbers, and one of the irrationality of the square root of 2. And when I read those as a student, I also fell in love with the power of mathematics to give you that kind of certainty about your subject. I mean, you know, science, again, it's a very evolutionary process. The science of the ancient Greeks got overturned. We don't teach that now. The mathematics of the ancient Greeks, we're still teaching that. So there's something I found very appealing about the security that proof gives you to know when you've got something right. And which in the sciences, you don't have that. You have a lot of evidence, but you can never be sure that your theory is going to survive in 200 years time. It might be quantum physics, beautiful, but that may just be wrong. And there may be a very good approximation to things, but actually, you know, it isn't a random roll of the dice. It's actually deterministic. And maybe we'll understand what the machinery is behind quantum physics.
I have a quick thought on that real quick. I've heard a very, very similar description of not only quantum mechanics, but also the knowability of things, but I've heard an extension to it. Somebody was talking about how confident they are, or how scientists are, in thermodynamics, especially post-Boltzmann. And they said, their comment was, I believe that the whole of quantum mechanics would be overturned before thermodynamics would be overturned. So do you have anything to say about how and I know this is a tangent, I just had to ask, do you have any comments on how confident we are in thermodynamics as a science? And you know, basically, what's your reaction to that comment, if I may?
Yeah, well, it's relates actually to one of my previous books, which in England was called What We Cannot Know. And in America, it was The Great Unknown. Because what is fascinating is, you know, what questions are there out there that by their very nature are unknowable? I mean, things like, thermodynamics is sort of trying to give you a language to tackle something which is quite unknowable, which is, you know, knowing the precise location of every single atom is impossible. But so you produce something called temperature, which is, a very good approximation of information about that system. But I think, you know, thermodynamics throws up something which I think actually, it comes up in Around the World in 80 Games, which is the idea of entropy. The measure of the disorder of a system. And that's one of the big mysteries, the second law of thermodynamics. Why are we tending towards a state of disorder? And sometimes local systems are actually reversing that. And so I think, there's so much fascinating physics, which I think will be challenged in the future. Quantum physics, the idea of the second law of thermodynamics, you know, maybe that is on the way to a theory. But for me, what was interesting in writing that previous book was, yeah, okay, but what questions by their very nature may be unknowable? For example, is the universe infinite? Well, if it is infinite, how could we ever know that? We have a bubble around us, which, you know, an event horizon beyond which we can't see anything. We don't have any knowledge because it can't reach us because the speed of light is this kind of ultimate speed limit for information reaching us. So that might be a question. The universe may be infinite, but we may never be able to know that sort of thing. So those are really interesting philosophical questions.
Okay. And I don't mean to interrupt. I know I've been hogging the floor a lot, Autumn, but I had to say two things. Number one, I want to gamify this episode. I want to challenge our viewers to help us turn this episode into a game, like maybe do a quiz after. I don't know, something. I'll think of a creative way of gamifying this episode. But further, you mentioned your old books. And I just, real quickly, you, oh my gosh, how many do I count? How many do I count? Like 12? How many books?
Oh, no. You have to be careful because in America and England, they call books different. So,
what's up, fools? Main Event Jey Uso here from the WWE. When it's just me between matches, it's day one-ish. And that means it's Chumba time. With hundreds of casino-style games and new titles arriving weekly, there's always something fresh to try at Chumba Casino. The daily boosts make it even more fun. And have me about to get them all during my downtime. Ready for a fun way to chill out and enjoy a few minutes for yourself. Let's chump.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
You're listening to a podcast right now. Driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own is free and easy. Upload an episode and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and hundreds more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads like this, even with just 10 listeners a month. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start free at rss.com.
Many people think I've written more books than I have because it's actually the same book. For example, my second book was about symmetry. In England, it was called Finding Moonshine. And in America, it was called Symmetry. And many people wrote to me complaining that they thought this was the follow-up and they found it was exactly the same book. So one of the problems about, you know, our global world is you can get access to American books on English Amazon, for example. So I think my games book is my eighth book, which still isn't bad going, you know. But...
No, not bad at all. And actually, I would love it if you wouldn't mind, if you could tell us just a quick preview about some of your former books. We would love that, actually.
Oh, lovely. Yeah. So my first book was about prime numbers. It's called The Music of the Primes, both in America and in England, about our greatest unsolved problem, the Riemann hypothesis. That was actually a bit of a response to Fermat's last theorem being proved. And I wanted to put something back in the public imagination as, you know, maths isn't finished yet. It's still lots we don't know, including, and that actually, that book had its 20th anniversary last year. So I did a new 20th anniversary edition with a new chapter about what had happened over the last 20 years. And then I did a book about symmetry, which is my own area of mathematics, which is something called group theory. Then I did a book, which is actually based on a set of lectures I gave for children at Christmas, something called the Christmas Lectures that we do, which was started by Michael Faraday back in 1825 or something. So I wrote a book based on those lectures, which is called The Number Mysteries. That's all about unsolved problems in mathematics as well. Then I wrote What We Cannot Know, which is all about unsolved problems. I wrote a book about AI and creativity, which is called The Creativity Code. Then a book called Thinking Better, which is all about the way mathematics is the art of the shortcut, something my teacher sort of told us when we were at school. And I really fell in love with that as a lazy teenager. Oh yeah, well, I'm going to do this subject if it's all about shortcuts. And then my games book. And then I did a little short book called How to Count to Infinity, which was great because it was a short book.
Nice. Very cool.
There you are. I think that's a guided tour around my back catalog.
Fantastic. I'm gonna refrain because I wanna give the floor to Autumn. I always have like six questions to ask, but I'll give you the floor for a second here, Autumn.
Absolutely. Like, I know that as you've been taking on this journey between the art and the mathematics and all of the various topics, I believe you said something in the book of where you know, tell me the game that you like and I can tell you all about yourself.
Yes.
So expand a little more on that for me, because I find that to be very interesting, especially like I've delved into a few specific niches in here and I'm curious on like.
Yeah. So I think you see, that was almost one of the motivations for the book, because, the reason that I wrote this book is for years I've been collecting games wherever I go in the world, because I think games are in some sense universal, but also very particular to a culture.
Yes.
So I would always love to find out, well, you know, if I'm in India or in China or South America, what sort of games do you play? And I did start to feel I was getting a kind of little window into their culture. So India is interesting because they often like to give themselves up to fate, and the role of the dice is a very important part. And I think, you know, so those people who enjoy losing, you know, letting go of control, some people do not like that. They do not like a dice involved in a game because they feel that's, they don't have agency, they don't have control, they want complete control of, and they, but some people really enjoy the role of a dice as disrupting the rhythm of something. And so I saw that in India, and very strikingly, chess, for example, is a game which has its origins in India and Persia, but originally that game was played with a dice, because they would roll the dice to decide which piece you were allowed to move next in the game. Now, we think of chess as a pure strategy game, and to think that you were restricted in what you could do by the roll of the dice, that forces games in a very different direction. But when gambling was banned in India, they weren't allowed to use dice. And then somebody said, well, why don't we just choose which piece? You know, it's still quite a good game. So even the games that we think were pure strategy games, originally they had a dice involved. So whilst if you go to China, I found China was a place where they were less interested in using a dice. Still, chance was involved, because something like Mahjong, which tiles you get given at the beginning, is an element of chance. But then it's what you do with those. You, from that moment on, you have quite a lot of control on, well, I suppose you're still picking things from the wall, and so there's a chance of which tile you'll get. And, but I still felt there was a lesser sense of giving yourself up to the fate of the roll of the dice, for example. And a big difference again between China and India, which I thought was quite striking, is that India, they're quite aggressive, the sort of games they're playing. Chess, you know, you're whacking this piece off the board. It's real hand-to-hand combat going on in chess. Whilst Go, for example, is a much more territorial sort of war game, where you're placing these black and white stones down on this 19 by 19 grid, and the aim is to gradually control swathes of land. And then again, if you look at card games, what's the card game that came out of India? It's a version of Whist, which is capturing people's cards in tricks. And you hold their cards, you know, because you won them. Whilst if you look at the card games that are played in China, Mahjong is a kind of card game, but played with tiles. You're collecting things. It's more like Rummy. It's, you know, you're trying to get runs of things. You're trying to get all the dragons or all the fours of bamboo. And so there, again, it's a more cumulative game. You're gradually building up your hand, which you then lay down to win the game. So I thought that was quite a striking difference. So again, you know, what sort of game do you like playing? Do you like playing a pure strategy game? Do you like a game which, like, I like backgammon because it has strategy and chance. I don't want just chance. I mean, Snakes and Ladders is a fun game when you're a kid, but you want to express yourself through a game. You want agency. You want to assert whether you're an aggressive player, a risky player, a defensive player. And something like backgammon I quite like because there's strategy. Yet I also quite like a bit of chance in a game, because I want the person who may be a little bit weaker still to have a chance of winning the game. And that was, I wrote these kind of six qualities that I think make a good game. And one of them is, I don't want the game to finish before it starts, where if you're playing somebody who's really good at chess and you're average, it's, the game's finished. You know, Gary Kasparov against Donald Trump is never, ever going to be an interesting chess match. But it might be an interesting backgammon game, you know. So I think that's quite important that, you know, some games have a handicap system so that if you are really good, they will take a number of points off you. So Go, for example, there's a handicap system. So if you're a really good Go player, you have to win by a certain number more points than if you are just equally matched. And so that's quite good. If a game has that flexibility to introduce a handicap so that a weak player still can win the game.
Yeah, I find that to be just as interesting because I saw that you took it into a twist with everything from, as you narrated, from tarot all the way to Pokemon to Magic the Gathering and even NFTs. Most people don't usually talk about that stuff. I've been big in the crypto space and Web3 space for a while, and I just found that to be fascinating for the parallel, as I do play Magic the Gathering competitively.
Oh, just great.
Seeing
yeah.
how that like parallels with that. And I'm like, you're one of the first people to actually talk about this.
Right. Yeah.
So like, well, I'm curious on like how you see like those applications, not only in like the NFT side of things, but how does that parallel like for long term, for gameplay?
Yes, yeah. I mean, I was quite struck to discover the role of NFTs in games, where basically you can cash your NFTs in, or you can combine NFTs to make kind of new cards, as it were. So,
how to have fun anytime, anywhere. Step one: go to ChumbaCasino.com.
ChumbaCasino.com. Got it.
Step two: collect your welcome bonus.
Come to Papa, welcome bonus.
Step three: play hundreds of casino-style games for free.
That's a lot of games, all for free.
Step four: unleash your excitement.
Woohoo!
Chumba Casino has been delivering thrills for over a decade. So claim your free welcome bonus now and live the Chumba life. Visit ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
You're listening to a podcast right now. Driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own is free and easy. Upload an episode, and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and hundreds more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads like this, even with just 10 listeners a month. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start free at RSS.com.
That seemed a really interesting technology. I'm quite interested in, I guess, having written that book about artificial intelligence, and my son worked for a couple of years for a startup, which was, basically they were using the blockchain to authenticate art. And then they realized after a while, oh, we are an NFT minting company. It was before NFTs were a thing. What is quite curious is how NFTs suddenly went hugely toxic. And so now you can't really talk about NFTs because everyone goes, oh, they're terrible things. So, you know, now we talk about a digital certificate or something. But I still think
it's the same exact thing.
It's exactly the same thing, of course. So, but I think there's, you know, I'm quite interested in the role that something like blockchain will play in, for example, the gaming space, because, you know, one of the issues with gaming online is trust. And being able to play, you know, has somebody genuinely got those cards that they say they have in poker? Or in, so the role of technology and things like the blockchain and you know, cryptographic systems to be able to play games in a fair way and to play games, in a mass online way. I mean, my mother is quite interesting because she plays a lot of online games. She's part of quite a lot of tribes across the world. And, you know, the idea of your, I think she spent most of our inheritance actually on digital swords and shields. But, you know, being able to own those and transfer ownership of those, you know, I probably will receive ownership of these incredible digital armory. But the
Make
power
sure
of
you have the keys.
Exactly. Well, exactly.
It's
that's
in the well.
So the way that, yes, exactly. So all those passwords, I'm going to have to. But that's what, you know, interesting digital technology can allow for ownership of these digital assets and to be able to play collectively online in a fair way. I find really really interesting. So, you know, that was the interesting trajectory of the book, to start in the ancient world with early racing games. That, you know, there's this 5,000 year old game in the British Museum here in London, which is, you know, the early forerunner of backgammon, but through right through to the modern day, where you're playing games using blockchain technology. You know, that's the beauty of this whole story, is how it's been there in part of our culture in different ways, reflecting our culture in different ways. Just exactly tell me the game that of that period, and you can understand something about that period in history.
Absolutely.
Wow. As you bring that up, I'm thinking about this book, and I wish there was a way to tell where this book or books like this, like who read it. I wish that information was available, because I wonder about anthropologists and this book specifically, just because the cultural relevance of games, both for sharing culture and for leisure and for building trust in communities. I mean, gosh, I think about like every single corporation and their efforts to do team building activities using silly games. They're trying to play on the psychology of games. So like, I don't know. I think that this book, like, If there were to be blogs based on your book, hint, hint, like for us as well, if there were to be blogs reflective on this, I would love to explicitly tag certain anthropologists that would be most effective for expanding upon it more. That's something you definitely could do. By the way, with the Breaking Math effort, that's what we're trying to do, is we're trying to build bridges to mathematics and everything else, like a really cool spider web. At some point, I'll have to tell you about our math tree that builds on the map of maths that another creator made. Remind me to go to that topic before this episode is out. But
cool.
Yeah, I just had to do a quick little note that will show up in the transcript to make some blogs and tag all of your anthropologists and culture friends who want to talk about games in different cultures and the role they play and how, like if you're visiting cultures, I don't know, how you might use a game to build trust. Like they say, never, you know, never beat your boss at poker. You know what I mean? Things like that. So.
It was very interesting how many different sort of intellectual areas were touched by this topic. I mean, so, you know, the anthropologists have been talking about games, of course. They're an amazing insight into a culture. And so, you know, I quote Heisinger, for example, who wrote Homo Ludens, and he talks about our species being the playing species. In philosophy, games were very important to Wittgenstein. He used the idea of the word game actually in his description of what he thought was how we learnt language, the word games, language games, that we only understand what a word means by actually playing with it. We can't define a game in a dictionary. We can't define a word in a dictionary manner. That will never, you know, that's perhaps a helpful way of getting towards it, but the only way we know what a word means is by using it. And the word that he thought best exemplified this whole thing was the word game. So, and then in psychology as well, the role that games have played in psychology, and you know, we've seen that with the idea of gamification, making everything into a game to incentivize people. A lot of industry is realizing people love playing games, and if you can change it into something people do not like doing into a game, you know, like Duolingo, for example. I think Duolingo fails because actually it becomes too much of a game. So, you know, I learned Spanish for a year and a half and came, you know, it was a really high level in this game. Then I went to Mexico and realized I'd learned no Spanish and that all I'd done was to learn how to gamify the game. And so, you know, I think you need to be careful making sure people are having fun, but they're actually achieving what they, what the gamification is meant to achieve.
Oh, man. Okay. And so as you just mentioned that, an hour before this interview, I was reading over the show notes. That's where all my ideas came for expansions on it. And one of the things I wanted to do is see what efforts exist already in gamifying legitimate, huge fields of knowledge. I mentioned not only mathematics, but you know, the field of medicine, the field of law, the fields of engineering. And I just thought, what way, like, yeah, you're not going to become an engineer the same as if you had gone through a formal program, but you could even like just thematically, like the wallpaper, make some kind of a game that is inspired by people that have made it through, you know, like a school of law. You know what I mean? Like
yeah. Well, I think that's, you know, I talk about in the book. One of the games is a digital platform that I developed called mangahigh.com, which was, which I did with a colleague who'd, he'd done a startup about casual gaming online, playing Yahtzee, you pay a little money and whoever wins collects the money. And what he saw was people just getting so good at the games, being incentivized by game playing. And he came out of that startup saying, well, yeah, but what, wouldn't it be wonderful if actually people were learning something that would be useful? And so he came to me and said, look, mathematical education, you know, is really suffering. Can we gamify? And maths is quite nice because there's a correct answer. So you really, you know, in the humanities, it's a little harder to gamify writing an essay. But mathematics, you know, it is very, you know, you're building this pyramid, things are getting harder levels. It was sort of perfect. So we had a lot of fun, for example, changing, well, we have what's called GCSE, so it's the level for 16-year-olds, the exam that 16-year-olds have to take here in the UK. We just gamified the whole thing such that people, when they were doing homework, they just had to do, you know, reach level 10 on this game, which actually, when you've done it, you know how to solve a quadratic equation.
Okay, okay. Can we ring a gong at this point in the episode? Because this is where the Buddha would be very proud, because we realized why he wasn't allowing the games. And, sorry. I just have to laugh because, yeah, but I still disagree with the Buddha, because games children do naturally, and games, like anything, can have a wonderful component and an opponent where you become addicted to it and then you lose the original means of it. I just think it'd be cool to, in our actual podcast, to add a gong here. So, you know.
I approve of a gong.
Okay. And I don't want to say a thing more. I have like 5 questions in the barrel. I want to defer to you, Autumn, please.
But feel free.
Okay. Okay. Sure. Oh gosh. Where to even begin here? Okay. So you had mentioned earlier that another book of yours that I want to read, I wish I had time for it. Can you like make the, this isn't the question, but it is a question. Can you make like the book available in like a can you can just like slam, because I don't have time to read all the books. There's an app for that, isn't there? Insert sponsorship here for an app that does that. I'm just kidding. So you had mentioned your book on artificial intelligence. The Breaking Math podcast did a super deep dive, and actually I got a little bit of pushback saying, hey, I thought you were a math podcast. I was like, I am, you know, trust me.
Yeah.
But with AI, it serves as a function approximator in science and engineering, which I love, and it's also really weird. But I'm wondering, what have you been really impressed with, or what questions do you have about the use of machine learning specifically in the role of games?
Yeah, well, very interesting is games are often the thing where we realize that something new is emerging, because there are, I think that's the point about the game. It's a very beautiful, closed, safe environment to start exploring, you know, maybe your personality or your psychology, but also for AI, it's a very nice environment for just testing how good is machine learning at learning how to do something, learning to play the game of Go. So that book, The Creativity Code, the spark for that book was exactly the way that machine learning was able to create a piece of code that could play the game of Go at such a high level to beat the world's best Lisa Doll. Because traditionally, Go was considered a very hard game to write code for, because a lot of it is quite visual. The decisions you're making are about the visual patterns building up on the board, and that was very hard to crystallize into kind of top-down code about why you should make particular moves. And vision recognition software was always terrible before machine learning. So it's interesting that both vision recognition software and the ability to play this game, which is hugely patterned in the way that you make your decisions. But for me, the really exciting thing, which sparked the whole journey of that book about this new AI be creative, is that not only did it win a game against the world's best, we've seen that before. That's not so surprising. We saw Garry Kasparov being beaten by Deep Blue, but it actually taught us to play the game in a new way. It made a move, and it's now this famous move 37 in game 2 of AlphaGo against Lee Sedol. It is a move that was so new that And I call it the first creative act of an AI, because it was new, it was surprising. Everyone thought it was a very bad move when AlphaGo made that move. And everyone said, oh, well, Lee Sedol should win the game from this point on. But then very late on, it showed actually this surprising move had a lot of value because it helped AlphaGo to win that game. So, and it's taught us now to play Go in a new way. There have been three revolutions in the history of Go, one in about the 16th century, one at the beginning of the 20th century, and now this is a third revolution which has transformed the game. So that's really exciting because the learning process of the code, and it was the code itself that came up with that move and not a human who put that line of code in, because I think if a human had seen that line of code, which was basically very early on in the game, AlphaGo played quite deep into the center of the board. And traditionally, that's a very weak move that early on. A human would have deleted that line of code and said, no, that's bad, bad play. I mean, your Go master would say, no, no, that's a bad move. But AlphaGo, through its learning process, the machine learning, was seeing that this actually could be used is a very powerful move later on in the game. So that really emerged out of the learning process and I think deserves to be called the creativity of the code rather than the creativity of a human who started writing the code from which it then learnt. So I think games and AI are really fascinating kind of place to see how powerful AI is before it starts being unleashed on the real world.
Wow. Ooh, man, that's great. Sorry, every time I hear the story of AI playing Go and beating somebody, as you said earlier, having real creative things, I just get a shiver down my spine. Just because, to be perfectly honest, as you know, evolved creatures, there's just certain things, there's certain experiences that are just new to us, and being outdone at something that we thought was unique for, we just get a shiver down our spine. But then the other part of me thinks, okay, well, is there just going to be a part where we evolve further, even at a micro level, to just be used to that and not be so shocked every time it happens? You know what I mean? But it's just something about our cognition and our mental picture of ourself that gets just a little bit thrown cold water on, just a little bit, or a lot. It's interesting. Wow. If you don't mind, I wanted to just share a little bit of my thoughts on machine learning with a variety of games. I like to look at things like large language models and what it has been able to do in terms of simulating somebody having a conversation. And I've often thought of, if you have a game that has a large user base, something like, what's any massive multiplayer online RPG? Anything like the Final Fantasy XIVs or World of Warcraft or anything like that. I wonder, there's sufficient data sets where you can have machine learning take over any given part of that, whether it is building its own character, which you can build on the data set. Basically, so my question is, how many data sets exist that go into those games? And machine learning thrives where you have massive data sets. You could have machine learning assist with making a litany of similar characters. I wonder how easy it would be to make a litany of plots that drive missions, or use machine learning to create new environments. You know what I mean? Like it's different from your world. Or I have this idea that I have not seen worked out. I'm sure it's been done. Every single idea I've had, it's only a matter of time until I realize that somebody did it like 10 years ago.
Yes, exactly. I know that feeling.
Yeah. But I've got this crockpot slow. I don't know in Britain if the term crockpot is still used for a slow cooker. I have these ideas for a very slow cooker machine learning model where like how am I trying to explain this? It studies one player or one group of players, and it learns their mannerisms. And then from that, it designs environments that we would define through a reward function as interesting, based on the organic mannerisms developed in a small group. These are ideas that I want to see implemented in massive multiplayer online gaming. If I was in charge over it, I don't know, Squaresoft or Blizzard, or I know Blizzard has seen.
Well, I think there's some
days.
Very interesting, attempts to create video games which don't have such a limited narrative that everyone's following the same path. And I think, Zelda, the recent Zelda has been very interesting because they've allowed allowed players to explore combining components, which, they never planned what would be the result of mixing two things that you've collected in the game. And people that, you know, to create some code which can deal with that challenge of, you know, okay, somebody's going to put these things together, what will be the results? You know, they haven't had to write the code to say, yeah, if you put these three things together, it will make a flying machine which cooks pancakes or something. I don't know. But they created code which has been very flexible in just being able to cope with players' different weird and wonderful combinations of things that they've collected. So I think it's a really exciting time. You know, what you want is code that can produce unexpected results, so you don't have to programming everything in. And in the past, of course, our top-down coding meant we had to know sort of what everything was going to do. Now with machine learning, we don't. And that opens up, you know, if it's done well, such exciting possibilities. And I mean, I haven't played the Zelda that's just come out with this possibility to fuse, but people I've talked to have just said it's amazing because you can be so creative within the game.
Oh my gosh. As you say that, it just dawned on me. I've been watching, there's a professor here in the United States at the University of Washington on YouTube, Professor Steve Brunton, has a whole series that's a really great intro to machine learning. And he describes the process. It just dawned on me from what you were saying. If there were to be a game that involved machine learning, the reward function would be users using, like, are your users continuing to use it or are they not? And have a direct reward.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
You're listening to a podcast right now. Driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own is free and easy. Upload an episode, and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and hundreds more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads like this, even with just 10 listeners a month. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start free at RSS.com.
Board function that was tied with the optimizing function directly to the changes you recently made. Like, that could be really cool and scary. Yeah. Addictive too. I know it would be scary addictive, but
you know, the other thing I thought that where machine learning would be really useful is in creating the music behind a particular video game, because everyone's playing the game in a different way. And the moment it's quite clunky, so you might move from one area to another and the music will change. But what you really want is music that is starting to respond to gameplay, your particular personality, and just the way you're navigating the game. And you know, having a human do that is almost impossible, but that's perfect for, you know, so you have a human which puts in the kind of early material for the game, but then the machine learning actually melds the soundtrack to your gameplay. That seems a no-brainer in just a wonderful fusion of the human and the machine.
I think that
I have
would be
dreams.
Something...
Oh, I'm so sorry. Go ahead, Adam, please.
Like, that would be something perfect for if you're doing a RPG like Baldur's Gate 3, and that would take it in through each scene and each emotion, because I know that depending on how you interact, coming in like bottom up, really changes the outcome of how you're going to play. And you can even play as the cat.
Yeah. These are, I think, just the power of this technology to open up the creativity of the player. It is really exciting.
And it makes me wonder, like, how does that also change bringing in AI and machine learning for how we interact as humans, right? So a lot of the card games and board games, you're interacting in person with people. And a lot of the times you're gaming with your friends online, but you don't have those same interactions. How does the AI change our perception of reality, in which, you know, your best friend can be some 18-year-old.
Yeah, well,
and you don't see that on the other end.
Or 80-year-old, because this is one of the things my mum loves. You know, my mum loves just the mask that online gaming provides. So she can be involved in a tribe, be a really big fighter within that tribe, and yet nobody realizes it's actually an 80-year-old granny down in Cornwall playing. She was actually, I think I put the story in the book, actually, that she'd been playing with this whole group of people as part of a tribe in some online game. And then one of the people wrote on the chat, "Oh, I'm afraid Manuel can't come next week to the fight." And my mum said, "Oh, why?" And said, "Well, unfortunately, he's got to go to prison and he won't have access to his games consoles." And as she learned more, she realized that the whole tribe was basically a Mexican drug cartel operating out of Chicago, and they were using the game as a kind of useful sort of downtime, or I don't know, maybe even communicating. And basically my mum was like the leader of this tribe, this 80-year-old granny and Mexicans running a drug cartel in Chicago. So, you know, it's interesting the worlds you get access through gaming.
Oh my gosh, the interconnectivity. Oh my gosh. Oh wow. Yep.
Oh, but it's interesting because, you know, a lot of the games I talk about in the book actually are about physical games, games you hold in your hand, you know, hand rather than digit. The digital is all about your finger, not your hand. And I quite like the physicality of a game is quite important. And that includes actually sitting around a table with people physically. And I think that's why board games have maintained their popularity even in the digital age, is that we still crave that contact with our fellow human across the table. And I think that's one reason I think games developed in the first place is creating an environment for us to share our inner world, our consciousness, our family, our friends. And so although I talk about video games and digital games in the book, it's not a major part of the book. My wife said I should have put loads more in because then the kids would buy the book. But actually, I still think kids, you know, my son's been playing board games, even, you know, he loves playing his PS4, 5, whatever. But he also loves the physicality of sitting around with bits of cardboard pushed out of and put on the board, you know.
It really does make the difference because I think the generational difference for where you are versus where I am, probably at a closer age, like to your son, like I enjoy playing video games online, but also I do enjoy going to the conventions and meeting my friends, and sometimes they're 20 hours away or they're 6 hours away across the country. I have friends coming up this weekend. They're like, "We're going to the convention that's close to you." And they're like, "You're coming, right?" And I went, "What?" I didn't even know this one. They're like, "Yeah, so we're going Friday through Sunday. Let's go." And it's just seeing them instead of just texting, being online. It's the physicality of being on, like, in person, playing Pokemon, Lorcana, Magic.
Yeah, exactly. And also just the physicality of those cards, I think, is something magical.
Absolutely.
That's why cards have always had a potency about them. Why, you know, of course, tarot, as I explained in the book, was originally an Italian card game. You know, the major arcana were trump cards in that. But, you know, the power of them then to go on and become this fortune-telling side of the cards, which is, you know, a later thing. Tarot cards, I think most people thought were invented because of fortune telling, but actually that grew out of a game. So I think the physicality of these things have a charm and a magic around them. In particular, you see cards, I was very fascinated to discover, have their origins in India probably, and they have these wonderful things called Ganjifa cards, which are circular cards, and they're beautifully painted like little Indian miniatures. They're very expensive to make because every card is hand painted, and essentially they were wiped out as a species by the French European cards, which came in, were so easy to print, the cards that we used to playing with. But I'm seeing when I've gone back to India, I found a few studios which are reintroducing these beautiful cards. And whenever I go to the museums in India, I found just examples of these. They're so beautiful. You just want to hold them. And you know, I think we still love the physicality of a game is an important aesthetic part of it.
I know that games and cards are being, you know, they're often associated with children, but I wonder how successful anyone could be if they tried hard to make, like, just collecting silly cards that are literally just Pokemon cards, but for grown-ups. Like, I'll bet you could do it in the automotive industry, you know, like sports cars. Well, but then I got to think, I have this litany of really, really silly media productions in my head. Like, I used to watch the channel College Humor, and they had a whole video about a breakfast cereal mascot for grown-ups, where it was this boring old reverend who was philosophical, and you know, the cereal was for, like, steel cut oatmeal, and he showed up and this gong played, and he was always like, perhaps I can win your cereal in a game of cards. No, very well, I abhor games of chance. Then I'll ask you in a straightaway manner. It's a very funny video, but I say all this because I'm serious. If somebody just took upon the challenge to make an addictive game like Pokemon, but make it for grown-ups, what symbolic thing would you put on the cards? So I don't know, just a thought, just putting it out there. So,
well, I think Magic the Gathering, in a way, was a game that was, you know, that was a game that came before Pokemon, and then it's an interesting thing, you know, to have a game where the actual cards, collecting the cards in their own right, is beautiful, but also actually
right being on able my to desk.
Yes, I'll bring out my desk in a moment. It's on the back of the bookshelf behind me. But I think I think Magic the Gathering is a game that was more appealing to adults than it was to children. I mean, it was, yeah.
Oh, and you'll excuse me. I realized time-wise, we are over an hour. I have more questions. We could go forever. My issue is that I actually am due at my job. My boss gave me until my time, 11 o'clock a.m., which means that I have to wrap up soon. I wish I could pass this on to you, Autumn, and you guys could go until you feel it was appropriate. But I did want to mention real quickly the topic, the math map. I wanted to mention real quickly as one of our initiatives. When I was talking with Autumn, so Autumn joined this team recently because you may or may not be aware, the first person that your publicist corresponded with was the beloved late Sophia Baca. Sophia and I were the co-founders of the Breaking Math podcast, and tragically, we lost Sophia this last year. She passed away.
Yes, I was very sorry to hear that. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Thank you. I appreciate that. I've been in great contact with Sophia's parents, and Sophia's parents greatly approve of the podcast going forward. And there's been lots of conversations about how to outreach to various communities that Sophia was very close to, and how to bring enjoyment of math to them through this podcast. And I've talked to them at great length about Autumn, and I hired Autumn because I need help. I'm a dad of five kids, and my time to do the podcast is like tiny, you know what I mean? And I'm constantly interrupted with, like, oh no, a glass broke. Oh, the dog got into the kid's toy. Oh, the kids, you know, poured the cereal all over the ground. It's all kinds of fun here. I hired Autumn because I needed so much help. And then it turns out Autumn is not only a social media manager, but has her undergrad, ingrad, and in industrial engineering. All this to say, we had a powwow about where the podcast is going. And in the powwow, I found a map of mathematics that somebody had made. And I thought it was, number one, brilliant. If you go to YouTube, I think it's, oh gosh, I always forget the channel. There exists a map of mathematics. I want to extend the idea of the map of both pure and applied math and all the connections. I want to make a version of it that is clickable. I want to make it more like a tree that has a time element that has all of the podcasts that we've done already and where we haven't even gone yet. Because in every RPG, every video game, the excitement is looking at a map and thinking, oh, I haven't gone there yet. And I think that it would be helpful if I took, we've got, what, between 90 and 110 episodes, if you count the mini episodes, and I could do every topic that we've done and make it clickable. And then when you hover your mouse over it, the intention is to make it so that you know, the terms are defined, the episode is summarized, but then connections are made to other branches of either mathematics or non-math topics, such as, I don't know, medicine or politics. And I only share this idea because this idea, I think, could take any form by any creator, by anybody who has a history in math publishing. And since I am already borrowing the idea from Map of Mathematics, I just bring it up like, shoot, if anyone else has more time than this busy dad and wants to go crazy with it, you know, I'm sharing this idea hoping that it land either I get around to making it or somebody shares it. So yeah, I just wanted to share that. So
sounds very exciting. Yes, I'll look forward to clicking on it.
Yeah, cool, awesome. And then the other thing I'll say is, as we're wrapping up, so I have to wrap up, unfortunately, and I wish, if you were logged in as an admin, Autumn, and I apologize, I didn't think about this, you guys could carry on.
Well, I also have a call I got to make to India in a few minutes' time, so this will probably be a good time for wrapping up as well. So,
yeah. Okay. Is there any remaining plugs for anything at all? Future books, past books, other topics, causes, anything that you would like to plug on the show as we are wrapping up?
Well, I'm hoping everyone will be excited to buy the games book now. As I mentioned, I've also got this book that I'm currently writing, which my deadline is in a few months' time from my editor. So I probably shouldn't be talking to you, but I should be writing, which is called Blueprints.
Blueprints.
And I also have a play that I've written, which is about one of my mathematical heroes, André Weil. And the play is a kind of exploration of... Well, it's actually an exploration of free will through his biography about why he made a particular choice in his life and whether we really have free will or not. But also about his mathematics, because he proved what I regard as one of the great theorems of the 20th century, which he proved whilst he was in prison. So the play starts with him in prison. So that I'm taking on tour in India in the autumn of this year. And I would love to bring it to America, because I think American audiences would be very interested. So if there's anyone out there who'd like to sponsor a tour of this wonderful new play called The Axiom of Choice around America, then I would love to hear from you.
Oh my gosh. Let me, I have some connections. I don't know that I have ones that'll bite. You know how it goes. Everybody knows somebody.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes.
For what it's worth, that's awesome. The Axiom of Choice. Free will is trending right now. I'm sure you've seen, what's his last name? I apologize. Robert Sapowski, or I would Google it, but I'm talking to you on my phone right now. He wrote a book called Determined. He's a biologist and he believes there's no free will. And I find myself that all, okay, just to full cards on the table. Aho, the pun, get it? Full cards on the table. Ba-doom-tsh. Okay, sorry. Full cards on the table. The more I study it, I'm finding that all roads lead to Rome being his conclusion that there is no free will. I hope there is, but that's where everything reading.
I think that's the easy option. And I think the real challenge is, can you, with all that we know, prove that there is free will? So I think that's actually this book here, which I've got on my desk right in front of me, is called Why Free Will is Real by Christian List. It's basically a philosopher. And he does a really good job of, even in a deterministic universe, why we have free will. And it's not just
an
illusion.
And I'm sorry, I'm American. I don't have a fancy glass of like a really nice cognac. I will do my best as an American.
If I told you what I was drinking right now.
Oh my gosh. That's crazy.
Can we get a sponsorship deal with certain energy drinks?
Well, I'm just got bicycle oil.
Yes. I raise a glass to anybody defending free will. I do.
Yes.
I hope they win. May they win. It's just that I find myself on the other, you know, the materialist Sabine Hosenfelder side. Oh, yeah. So, yes, sir. I hope that anything may come of what you've mentioned. I think that your book is a garden that is ripe for blooming in many topics. And I hope to be part of that. We're literally, Autumn and I are talking about what interns can we hire and put on a project of just dissecting your book and similar books and making like, I don't know. I got to see what already exists out there. But like,
wonderful.
There's so much to talk about.
Well, interesting projects.
Yeah.
Yes, yeah. I'm very excited by the inspiration it's giving you.
Thank you. And I do need to mention this. I saw that the chair that you currently occupy, or did occupy, I don't know what the current status is the same one that Sir Richard Dawkins held before you. Is that correct?
He did, yes. I'm the second holder of this chair. It's the Simone Chair for the Public Understanding of Science, and Richard was the first holder of the chair. And when he retired, I was the one who got it next. So it's a wonderful chair.
Wonderful.
Nice. Instead of talking about the God Delusion, we talk about games. It's a little more dining room table. So the difference here is you can talk to your grandma about it. So, I'm going to get in trouble on this podcast. Okay, I better go drive off to work. Sir, it has been beyond a pleasure. I would like to follow up with what we intend to do with this. There's been about a month-long turnaround on editing and getting this stuff out. We might get this one out faster, depending on various things. But please look forward to hearing us in the future.
Absolutely.
And I
well.
Don't know when.
Before we end today's episode, don't forget that we are doing a social media giveaway of a free copy of the book Around the World in 88 Games by Professor Marcus du Sautoy. In order to be in the drawing for the giveaway, be sure to check out our social media and follow the instructions on the post labeled Book Giveaway. Again, you'll find a post on both the X, which used to be Twitter. If you follow us at Breaking Math Pod on X, you'll find a post with the title Book Giveaway, and also you'll find a similar post on Instagram. Our Instagram handle is at Breaking Math Media, and there are specific instructions for what you have to do. It includes tagging a few friends, sharing, liking, and following a few things, including the book publisher as well as the book author. And when you follow the instructions exactly, you'll be in the drawing for a free copy of the book. Thank you for joining us, and I hope you enjoyed today's episode.
Hey, it's Cole Swindell, and when I spend 200 days a year rolling down the highway, the bus can start to feel smaller than a guitar case. Everyone wonders how I stay chill while the hours crawl by. Truth is, one good luck spent on Chumba, and suddenly the trip feels a whole lot shorter. Finding your space, even when there isn't much to spare. Need some chill? Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus T&Cs apply. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
You're listening to a podcast right now. Driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own is free and easy. Upload an episode and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and hundreds more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads like this, even with just 10 listeners a month. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start free at rss.com.